The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests. Carol Leonig and Philip Rucker are the authors of the number one best-selling book, A Very Stable Genius, described in the New York Times as a taut and terrifying account of Donald Trump's shambolic tenure in office to date. Their brand new book, I Alone Can Fix This, just jumped right to the number one spot on the Times combined print and ebook list. So congratulations to you both. A national investigative reporter at the Washington Post, Carol Leonig won Pulitzer Prizes in 2014 for revealing the US government's secret domestic surveillance efforts, and in 2015 for her coverage of the Secret Service's misconduct and security failures. Her reporting about the Secret Service was the basis of her New York Times bestselling book, Zero Fail: The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service. The senior Washington correspondent at the Post, Philip Rucker, was part of a team of Post reporters, which also included Leonig, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2018 for its coverage of Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. He is the recipient of the George Polk Award and the Aldo Beckman Award from the White House Correspondents Association. Both writers work as on-air political analysts for NBC News and MSNBC, as does their interviewer, Andrea Mitchell, the chief foreign correspondent of NBC News and anchor of the eponymous Andrea Mitchell Reports on MSNBC. Mitchell has received numerous awards, including the prestigious Goldsmith Career Award for Excellence in Journalism from the John F. Kennedy School of Government. And she has interviewed everyone from Castro to Clarence Thomas, or as she's titled her memoir, Talking Back to Presidents, Dictators, and Assorted Scoundrels. It's great to have you with us. The screen is now yours.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. It's great to be back with the Free Library of Philadelphia community, which is a home away from home for me, and to have the excitement of interviewing my friends Carol and Phil, who are extraordinary reporters every day in the Washington Post and with their books, award-winning books. And so excited about number one on the combined list on the New York Times as you debut on the list. Not only have you written in this book the first draft of history of the last year of Donald Trump, of his presidency, but you've written a history that is so revealing, so insightful, it's going to hold up as a literary document, I think, for all time, about one of the most consequential years in American political and cultural history. So welcome to our authors. Welcome to all of you. And Carol and Phil, I want to start with something that is the most immediate in a lot of our consciousness right now, which is January 6th, especially because of the hearing that was held just yesterday. And the first person accounts of the violence and the terror from those four remarkable officers. Liz Cheney's first question to the officers was about something that Donald Trump told you in your interview, calling it a loving crowd. And she asked one of the officers about it, and his response was that he is still recovering from those hugs and kisses from the rioters and the terrorists that day, he said. If that was hugs and kisses, we should all go to his house and do the same thing to him. It's just one of the ways that your interview with the president, the former president, and your book is still resonating in a daily basis with headlines all the time. So tell us about the interview and his recollections of the insurrection. Carol, first to you.
Andrea, as you know from interviewing presidents, dictators, and scoundrels, it was our great pleasure in some respects to sit down with him for 2 hours and 45 minutes at Mar-a-Lago and let him tell us his view of reality. Unfortunately, it was not very moored to fact. In most cases, He told Phil and me that he was one of the best presidents in history. He told us, with regard to January 6th and focusing on that exclusively, that many people had misreported these events and that Capitol police officers were warmly ushering individuals into the Capitol. We, had our jaws on the floor, metaphorically, a lot of the t interview. But it was interesting, too, because Donald Trump has hardened his inner narrative since he left the presidency. And while he once thought maybe he did lose, he's now absolutely compelled and propelled to tell us and to tell the world that he was robbed of his second presidency and that he is going to make a mark in the Republican Party. He's going to be the person that decides who gets elected to that party and to and which Republicans serve in the Congress. And he insisted over and over again that he did a fantastic job as a president in 2020. On COVID, he had only really one regret, which we can talk about a little later.
Yeah, I do want to raise that a little bit later. So, on January 6th, from your reporting, you have extraordinary detail about what was happening that day with his speech and then watching the riot and his reactions. Share that with all of us tonight.
Yeah, so we knew that there was this mystery in real time about what President Trump was doing in those initial hours after the rioters laid siege to the Capitol on January 6th. And so when we were reporting this book and going back after the fact to interview these firsthand witnesses and senior government officials, we wanted to piece together what Trump was doing. And what we learned was pretty chilling, actually. He was watching television for the whole kind of first couple of hours in the private dining room, which is just off of the Oval Office in the West Wing. It's where Trump had his 60-inch TV and would go there for hours of the day, every day, to watch television. And he liked what he saw. He was happy with the images of his supporters climbing the steps of the Capitol, of them waving his flag, of them wearing red Make America Great Again hats. He thought this was a show of force to try to overturn the election results, and he was proud of them and pleased to see so many of his people there. It wasn't until things turned truly violent and lethal even that Trump started to recognize that this wasn't a happy moment, that there was danger here. And yet he didn't act the way a president normally would. He was effectively AWOL as the commander in chief. He did not call to see if Vice President Pence was safe and okay. He did not communicate to the Pentagon to try to get National Guard approval to go to the Capitol or to mobilize some sort of a military or federal law enforcement response to bolster what were completely outmanned and beleaguered Capitol police forces. And instead, he had to be persuaded multiple times by his advisors, including his daughter Ivanka Trump and the White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, to be convinced that he needed to tell his supporters to stand down and to go home and to stop being so violent. He eventually did that, but it took a couple of hours. And it was a period of time when the president, according to the sources who were in the room, had largely abdicated his duty and responsibility on the job.
And your reporting on this, we knew that he hadn't reacted. We knew about the delay, but your detailed reporting, especially his reactions or non-reaction to Mike Pence, where he was told repeatedly about the danger to Mike Pence, and so that whole relationship, I also want to spin out all your reporting on that. But his lack of empathy and lack of concern about his sitting vice president is just so character revealing, Phil.
It really is. And we should keep in mind who Mike Pence was for Donald Trump. He was the guy who stood loyally at Trump's side through everything, every controversy. He never broke with Trump. Even when the Access Hollywood video came out during the campaign, Pence expressed some regret for those, grab him by the you-know-what words on tape. And yet he stayed with Pence, or he stayed with Trump as the running mate. He was loyal to a fault Critics would call him a sycophant, and that's probably, frankly, a fair description of how he acted as vice president. It wasn't until January 6th, or the run-up to it, rather, when Pence ultimately decided he had to break with Trump because he felt he didn't have the legal authority to do what Trump wanted him to do, which was try to overturn the election results. That was not constitutionally permissible, according to Pence's analysis, and frankly, according to virtually every legal analysis of the Constitution. And so that became the breaking point in their relationship. But Trump, who just demands absolute fealty and loyalty from those around him, showed no empathy or remorse or even care for the vice president. You know, Pence's national security advisor, Keith Kellogg, was in the Oval Office with Trump on January 6th and was trying to give Trump updates on Pence's condition, on his whereabouts. And Trump just said, "How's Mike?" was told he was okay. Kellogg told Trump that his wife, Karen Pence, was with him. And Trump had no reaction to that. And it never occurred to Trump that he should pick up the phone and check on the VP or personally take control to make sure that he was going to be safe.
His wife and his daughter, Charlotte, and his brother, Greg, who was a member
That's
of Congress,
right.
According to your narrative. In that regard, Mike Pence that day, Carol, was so interesting because his Secret Service agents were understandably concerned and wanted to evacuate him quickly. And he refused to get in the car. Tell us about that.
You know, it's such an interesting day for Mike Pence. And I like the way Phil put it about the president being MIA, because as you'll see in our book, and you know this, Pence ends up being almost like taking over the role of commander in chief, the de facto president, because Trump is so missing. It's a harrowing day for Pence, however. It starts with him being rapidly evacuated from the Senate floor as an alarm goes through all the Secret Service detail agents, radio receivers, that the Capitol has been breached, the glass has been broken, and people are starting to riot and move into the building, stream into the building. As he's evacuated from the Senate floor, along with his wife, his daughter, his brother, and several aides, as he's rushed across that floor, it's seconds later, 30 to 60 seconds later, that rioters are charging up to that second floor landing and are literally in the hallway where he had just passed. That's how close he came to an attack, an assault. Remember that those rioters are chanting for his head. There is a noose, a faux noose out hanging outside waiting for him that has his name on it. Inside that hideaway room, Pence refuses two times when his detail leader comes to him and says, "We got to get out of here. This is not safe." Not only are hundreds of people streaming in, now it's in the thousands. The glass and the windows not secure. The detail leader wants him out. On the third instance, it's no longer a request, it's an order. They go to the subterranean basement with counter-assault agents, weapons drawn, to make sure that whatever they run into, they can take care of. It's also terribly frightening to think that there's that kind of special operator movement going through the Capitol to protect the vice president from Donald Trump's supporters. When they arrive, the detail leader wants him to get into the limousine because it's an armored vehicle. That's safer. Pence turns to him and says, "I trust you, Tim, but I am not getting in that car. I know the Secret Service agents. I know you guys. Somebody's going to drive away, and I'm not leaving this building." He did not want to be forced out. He wanted to finish the work of certifying the election. And, you know, Andrea, because you've covered this so closely, you know this, the vice president has a pretty unpleasant reputation as a nodding statue alongside President Trump. But on this day, he knows this is not right, and he is going to finish his work. He ends up that evening on the phone with the Secretary of the Army and with the Secretary of the Defense and also the leadership of the House and the Senate, but telling the Secretary of Defense, "This is what I want you to do. I want you to clear this building. I want you to get people over here right away." He's making the building safer. And he's also saying, "We are going to certify this election."
And I mean, that's remarkable in the sense that he could have copped out. If he had let the Secret Service evacuate him and he had every reason to let them do that, they would not have finished the job. And who knows what would have happened in the next 24, 48 hours.
It's an amazing split screen to think about. If he had just done what he'd always done, which is acquiesce to President Trump, there's a real question about whether or not we would have had a peaceful transfer of power.
There are other characters who will have major roles and still do going forward. One is Kevin McCarthy, because he has so attacked the committee, the select committee investigating all of this, after the Senate refused to grant a commission, which would have been, by most accounts, a much better independent, you know, nonpartisan paradigm, similar to the 9/11 commission, which was widely praised. So now we are here with the select committee and Kevin McCarthy, who is a key player. Phil, according to, you know, your writing, there was a phone call, Kevin McCarthy that day. So talk to me about that, because now he could become a potential witness.
Yeah. You know, Kevin McCarthy is a really critical figure in all of this because he's a Trump ally, obviously. And on January 6th, he was trying to communicate to President Trump the imperative that Trump speak out and get his supporters to clear the Capitol and to go home and to end the siege. And McCarthy made at least one phone call directly to Trump where they had a conversation. And the account that McCarthy shared of the conversation with some of his fellow Republican members of Congress depicts a fairly hostile discussion with Trump where they disagreed, and Trump spoke back to McCarthy. And there are some mixed reports about whether there might have been a second phone call between the two of them or if that was the only one. But it's important, I think, for the commission to try to find out what was said in that call, because McCarthy himself, to this date, has never spoken on the record about the conversation. He has never detailed in you know, dialogue or even tone what exactly was said between these two men. And you know, for the benefit of history, that could be a key piece in the investigation, but it also could shed light on the president's mindset, his state of mind in that moment, in that afternoon, and why he was so resistant to telling his supporters to go home and stand down.
A central character in your narrative, not only on that day, but more broadly throughout this final year, is Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Carol, tell us about Mark Milley and the role that he began to assume, especially during the final months of the presidency.
This is a moment, Andrea, that Phil and I were pretty stunned by as we learned it. It's a series of moments, forgive me. But, you know, June 1 is really a moment that is a lightning bolt in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs' mind. He has followed the president as requested across Lafayette Square as protesters are forcibly removed with rubber bullets and chemical spray. He hasn't known that this is going to happen. He just did what he was asked to do, follow the president out to see the protests. But that moment is such an authoritarian grab. And Milley is so stunned that he feels deployed, forgive me, he feels used, politically played. And he goes to bed that night pledging to himself and to his confidants that he's not going to let Donald Trump use him again or use the military for political purposes. As the fall and the summer proceed, Milley becomes increasingly concerned that President Trump is trying to undermine the reliability of the election, or I should say, undermine people's faith in the election. And after the election, when the president refuses to concede that he has lost, Milley's antenna goes straight up. He believes that there is a coup either afoot or by Trump or by some of his allies, that somebody is plotting. He gets late middle of the night phone calls from colleagues he trusts and even some mentors telling him, watch your back. There are some new Trump loyalists inside the Pentagon, and you need to be careful about what they're up to, what they're plotting. That coup fear is pretty scary and was scary to Phil and to me, because this is a man who has seen more than a dozen rounds of combat, and he is preparing now for a democracy to go off the rails. So worried was he about this effort. He was monitoring loyalists who he believed Trump was trying to insert over the head of the CIA to replace Gina Haspel, to replace Chris Wray, the FBI director, and even to install more people to replace possibly the sort of inner circle at the Pentagon. And this reaches such a panicky state for him that he and the members of the Joint Chiefs of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force begin discussing what they should do to prepare. If Donald Trump tries to grab control of the guys with the guns, those three agencies, what should they do if Donald Trump gives them an order to use the military in a way to sow chaos, to increase distraction, to stop that transfer of power that is peaceful? And they come up with this idea that Bill and I had no idea about until we began this deep excavation for the book. They began talking about resigning one by one, slowly, a reverse Saturday Night Massacre, if you will, just to throw their bodies in front of a dangerous move by the president that might hurt the country.
And he even compares the possibility of a coup to, the Trump speeches to Nuremberg, to those rallies, the Hitler rallies, and Reichstag moment.
Yes, he's very worried that increasing stress about what's going on starts with that November and December rallies, the Stop the Steal rallies that are the precursor to January 6th. In one of those rallies, Michael Flynn, one of the president's sort of closest, dearest supporters, and also a conspiracy theorist and whisperer in his ear in the later months of the presidency, begins talking about how the courts aren't going to decide this election. The people need to go and take to the streets, and they will decide the election. It's that first moment. And the president is amplifying that, is encouraging that. And Milley's view, as he shared with confidants, is this is so akin to the way Adolf Hitler consolidated power. This is the gospel of the Führer.
It's just extraordinary. Phil, Carol alluded to this earlier. When you talk to Donald Trump, his only regrets were what? Because it does relate to the military.
It does, Andrea. He only had one regret that he told us about from his final year of his presidency, and it relates to the protests that took place around the country in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd last summer. And, you know, that Trump wanted, and we learned about this a little bit in real time, but in a much deeper way in our reporting for this book, that day in and day out, he was pressuring his advisors to deploy military troops in Portland, in Seattle, in Minneapolis, you know, just across the street in the White House at Lafayette Square, where protesters were gathering to protest the racial injustice. He wanted to use the military because he wanted to look strong and he wanted to look tough heading into his reelection campaign. And his advisors, including Milley, but also Defense Secretary Esper and Attorney General Bill Barr, resisted him every time and said, you don't have the legal authority to do this. This does not amount to an insurrection, so you should not invoke the Insurrection Act. And by the way, if you send military into the streets, you're going to create a bigger problem. You could have a Waco on your hands. You could escalate the violence and the trauma in the streets of these cities. You need to let local law enforcement deal with it. And so Trump told us in the interview that he regretted not ignoring them and moving ahead to send troops into the streets. He said if he could do it all over again, he would. He would want to deploy active duty military in America's cities to try to quell the Black Lives Matter demonstrations.
In Portland, in Seattle, in Minneapolis, in Washington.
In all of those cities, yeah.
Which is just remarkable.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Bill Barr because, of course, he's very controversial with many people, the way he undermined the Mueller report with his initial release and misstated the conclusions of the Mueller report, but captured the headlines and the narrative. So for all of the reasons that he's controversial, you have several instances in the end, Phil, where he is standing up to the president. How did that relationship go sour? And what was the breaking point for Bill Barr to actually uphold the Constitution?
You know, it's a good point. Bill Barr, throughout the presidency, was seen as really the president's kind of personal lawyer. Trump was the puppeteer, and Barr was doing all the blocking and tackling on Trump's behalf at the Justice Department. And the relationship really took a turn earlier in the year 2020, because Trump was feeling the heat heading into his reelection campaign. He wanted some victories. And what we mean by victories is he wanted to see Jim Comey behind bars. He wanted to see his enemies prosecuted. He wanted to see Hunter Biden in jail. You know, he wanted to seek retribution politically, and he thought Bill Barr was obligated to, through loyalty, to deliver this to Trump. And the Justice Department doesn't work that way. So he was routinely pressuring Barr about, you know, what happened to the Durham report? That's the report looking into the origins of the Russian investigation. Why haven't you charged Comey yet? All of this pressure. But the breaking point in their relationship really came right after the election, when Trump pressured Barr to find the evidence to support the claims he was making about widespread election fraud. And indeed, Barr, you know, authorized the Justice Department to investigate these claims. And a team of prosecutors, investigators at DOJ looked into all of these allegations, but they found no such evidence. There was simply not the evidence there to support the idea that there was widespread fraud. And that was Barr's conclusion. Even a stalwart ally like Barr concluded that what the president was saying about the election was bunk. And Barr told the president that much, as much. He also said so in an Associated Press interview, I believe on December 1st, where Barr said for the first time, there is no evidence of enough fraud to have overturned or to have changed the result of the election. And that was a devastating blow for Trump. He was furious to see his, you know, handpicked, chosen, loyal attorney general making such a declaration. And at that point, the relationship was really over. And Barr felt he had no choice but to ultimately resign, which he did a few weeks later. And he was out the door before Christmas. And what we're learning more about tonight from our colleagues at the Washington Post, who just posted a story on this, is that Barr's replacement, the acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, came under the same relenting pressure in his final weeks on the job from Trump, almost every day pressuring Rosen to investigate fraud, to look into these claims, to find evidence to support the idea that there was fraud in the election. I mean, it just continued and continued.
I've been thinking a lot about Rudy Giuliani. I went to Ukraine to do some reporting on Giuliani a couple of months ago, but let's talk about, Carol, Rudy Giuliani on election night. What role did he play with the president?
In so many ways, Rudy Giuliani is on the spectrum of Trump supporters, on the far, far end of the anything you want to hear Donald Trump spectrum. He was the person who on election night set up what was essentially like a card table with a laptop on it, acting as if he were, you know, Steve Kornacki, you know, the control center for the election night, reading, spouting out the returns from different precincts and states and giving percentages, and his son sitting alongside him. There were people who felt that he was behaving erratically that night. But when the returns start to come in, and some swing states that are really important to becoming president are not looking good for Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani shouts out, just declare that you won. We just got to declare that we won. Just that is his strategy. And he repeats it several times for two different states. And then later tells President Trump, as Trump is really very, very upset about Fox News calling Arizona for Biden, he says, go out there, you know, Mr. President, and tell everybody you won. That's all you got to do. Just declare victory. This kind of la-la land takes over the presidency. And Rudy Giuliani becomes the embodiment of that from January, from the election forward to the end. The embodiment of people who tell the president what he wants to hear, you're not a loser, they become the only voices getting into the ear. And that evening, that becomes the Trump campaign strategy.
He was so untethered from reality, and you and Phil sat down with him and listened to him, insisting that he's actually won. Do you think he believes that, or is this part of a political strategy, Carol?
So just like you, I feel like one of my assignments as a reporter is to detect lies as they come out of people's mouths, to kind of understand through their body language, not to hinge all my reporting on it, but to feel that I know whether or not someone looks like they are misleading me. And with Donald Trump, when Phil and I sat down with him in Mar-a-Lago, I feel that he is so committed to this as being the truth. If he is lying, he is doing a really good job of persuading himself. He is doing a really good job of concealing that lie. He doesn't show any signs of deception. It could be that that's just his personality. I remember interviewing someone who was a very close aide of his during our last book together. And this person said that Donald Trump doesn't really know when he's lying because it's not important enough to him.
Phil, what about Ivanka Trump? She was certainly there on January 6th, as you report, in and out of the Oval Office. How does she, you write that she was tending to him in the tent during the rally backstage in the green room. How does she relate to him as a daughter, as a staff person,
yeah,
in terms of her own very carefully curated image?
She's a really interesting figure through these Trump years, and for a couple of reasons. First of all, she's clearly Donald Trump's favorite child. He's proudest of her. He likes being around her the most. He treats her far more seriously than he does his sons or Tiffany Trump. And that with that comes power. So she has access to him. She can walk into the Oval Office, could walk into the Oval Office whenever she chose to speak to him. And she would try to use her influence in ways that ultimately proved largely unsuccessful. She tried to moderate his tone on issues like immigration and race and women, and there was no moderation in his tone. She tried to convince him to stay in the Paris Climate Accords, and he, of course, pulled out. I mean, we could go on and on with the things that she tried to do to steer him from a policy and a rhetorical standpoint with very limited success. And so you fast forward to January 6th. Her husband, Jared Kushner, by the way, was in the Middle East on that day, so was largely absent from the discussions around the 6th or in the days preceding it regarding, you know, what Pence would do in the election fraud. But Ivanka was around. And the morning of the 6th, she decided that with this rally taking place, the Stop the Steal rally, that things could be a little bit harried, and she wanted to try to keep the president on an even keel. So she accompanied him to the rally on the Ellipse. Again, not very successful, because I don't think Trump was on an even keel as he gave that speech. We all saw it on television. But anyhow, she thought she could be a moderating influence. And then once the siege started and the riots happened, she, according to our reporting, was upstairs in her second floor office in the West Wing, saw it on TV, realized this was bad. Mark Meadows called her down to the Oval Office to try to help intervene with the president, because they were unable to get Trump to issue any sort of statement telling his supporters to back away. And so she would go in and out of the Oval multiple times, in and out of the dining room rather, multiple times, trying to plead with her father to tell his people to go home. She was successful ultimately, but it took a couple of hours. And then the statement that he gave was hardly the statement she would have advised. He did this Rose Garden video where he buried the lead. He started off by saying, you know, talking about the election fraud that didn't exist. And then he said, you know, go home. But then he said, by the way, we love you. We support you. So not a terribly effective moderating force, but nonetheless, she was one of them. And she did try to use her influence that day to steer her father in a better direction. It just didn't necessarily work.
Carol, tell us more about your interview also, because it's really performance art. He's on the patio at Mar-a-Lago. People are stopping by. I don't know how you conduct an interview during those circumstances, but somehow you manage.
You know, I'm really glad you asked, Andrea, because I remember when Phil told me where we were going to be interviewing him in a lobby. And I thought, well, this must be a mistake, except Phil really doesn't make any mistakes. So it was just a strange thing. But indeed, it was in the lobby of Mar-a-Lago, a beautiful room, by the way. Hats off to him, his decorator, and of course, Marjorie Meriwether Post, who built the structure. But I did feel as though we were part of a theater production, because as we sit down, it is the beginning, essentially, or the early beginning of the dinner hour. Guests are starting slowly, maybe a half hour in, to stream in. Why were we arranging an interview at 5 o'clock at the dinner hour at the Mar-a-Lago Club? So they start to stream in around the corner. Some very nice people are setting up a raw bar for dinner around the side. Couple other tables of pasta, etc. As the guests begin to come in, President Trump, former President Trump, is able to show that national reporters from Washington have come down to see him, that everybody wants an audience with Donald Trump. And vice versa, we are able to see all of the people coming in obsequious, blowing him kisses. Three pretty interesting people came by, Laura Ingraham, pretty famous Fox News host, calling out to the former president, Mr. Trump, you've got a Donald, forgive me, she called him, you've got to turn on tomorrow night. I'm going to have a great show. I'm going to really take it to those doctors who criticized you the other night. You should tune in. You'll love it. Dan Crenshaw, congressman, came in, emblematic of several, by the way, who are making a pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago, and wanted to tell President Trump, oh, you look so healthy, Mr. Trump. What's your secret? Again, all the flattery. Kimberly Guilfoyle, Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend, with whom he had just recently purchased a home not too far away as they're relocating in Florida, came over sort of sheepishly, tiptoeing over to our tete-a-tete to say, please, please, when you can, come over to my table. I'd love to introduce you to my friends. They're huge Trump supporters. And then when the interview is concluded, again, 2 hours and 45 minutes in, we get to see the gracious host invite us to dinner on his patio. And we also get to see that as he walks out onto those Moroccan steps and tiles, that there's a standing ovation for him and they play Hail to the Chief. It's, you know, almost his exile and his brigadoon. He's still president there. He's still the most important person. He's still king.
Phil, I want to get to questions in a moment, but also, do you sense a loneliness in any of this or desperation, or is this real contentment?
I definitely sense a loneliness and frankly, a thirst, a hunger, a desperation to be relevant still. You know, he's not in office anymore. He's not being flattered every hour. He's not being served things by the White House butlers. He's not being peppered with questions by people like us. He misses it, I think. And, you know, he loves the idea that journalists are flying down there to hear what he has to say. He loves the idea that these Republican lawmakers are coming to kiss the ring. I mean, he wants to remain king. And I think that's one of the main reasons why he's so motivated to run for president again. Because I don't think he wants to do the job necessarily. I just think he misses the attention and adulation he receives in the political limelight as a candidate and craves those rallies, craves the media attention and being in the headlines. And so, answer your question, yes, I think he's lonely and a little bit desperate these days.
And do you think desperate enough to actually want to run for president?
I think so. You know, he's got another year and a half or so to make that decision. And a lot can change in that time, including, frankly, his political standing. He may not be as popular with the base as he is today, but I think if he had to make that decision tomorrow, it would probably be yes.
I do want to turn to questions from all of our audience, as we can get to. We have one question about, with the insights of your book as a background, what did you hear after the January 6th committee meeting yesterday? What is your assessment of where and when this important issue is likely to go? Phil, if you want to take that.
Yeah, so the hearing yesterday was just really emotional and moving. And Andrea, you were anchoring it all from the live desk all day long. You know, I think that's the emotional high point of this whole process. And I think it gets a lot murkier and more partisan going forward. I have a feeling the commission is gonna have some difficulty getting the key Trump administration witnesses to come forward and testify. They may eventually testify, but it's gonna take some time. You know, they're the people who are gonna be able to answer some of the burning questions that the committee has, including What was the president's state of mind, his intent? What was he doing that day? How much advanced knowledge did he have of the plans for the riot and the insurrection? All of those are questions that this group is going to need to try to answer. And I think they're going to have difficulty finding ways to get that those answers, even with their subpoena power. But it was really interesting to see finally a hearing in Congress where everybody was talking about substance and asking serious questions. And there was some bipartisan agreement, sort of recognizing that Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are not, don't speak for their entire party, but they are Republicans nonetheless. And they were seeking the same truths and the same facts as the Democrats.
And Carol, one of our viewers wants to know, did you have any topics that you were forbidden to ask about?
We were not forbidden to ask Donald Trump anything, but we did have definitely some key topics we wanted to cover, a triage, if you will, of things that were priorities for us: COVID, the racial reckoning in our country, Black Lives Matter protesters, COVID again this summer arising, and then, of course, his undermining of the election and January 6th. Those were our really big topics, but we covered a lot more thanks, honestly, to Donald Trump being willing to sit with us longer than he did with anyone else. And, you know, as he said later, as he said goodbye to us, you know, it's kind of a sickness. I really enjoyed it. He really enjoys talking about his presidency. And even though he's called Bill and me some pretty unpleasant names and criticized our reporting and tried to deride it, he said he was flattered to be asked all these questions.
And Bill, is Trump worried about being indicted for his actions or inactions on January 6th? And I could extend that to say, is he worried about other aspects of the criminal investigations in various venues?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to answer that question definitively, Andrea. I think he's worried, he's perpetually worried about legal troubles and being ensnared in these mm-hmm. investigations. I have a feeling he's more concerned about what's happening in New York as it pertains to the Trump Organization and what the financial you know, repercussions could be for his company, for his family fortune, and whether his children or even himself, you know, become ensnared in that. In terms of January 6th, I mean, he made it through the impeachment proceedings fine, and there were no criminal charges, obviously, in the immediate aftermath of the 6th. And so it certainly seems like that was a relief to him. Whether he continues to be concerned about what Merrick Garland and the Biden Justice Department might do in the months ahead, I'm not sure. But I think New York is the more pressing source of anxiety for him.
Carol, do you believe he is truly sick, or are these behaviors that he's learned through years and is just continuing these behaviors?
You know, I think that we really try our hardest to avoid weighing in on areas where we have so much less expertise. We're journalists, we get the facts, and we're not really weighing in on mental health because that's not our profession. I've read and I've interviewed many mental health professionals who believe that Donald Trump has a narcissistic personality disorder and displays, you know, a multitude, overwhelming multitude of the factors that play into that. But that's diagnosing from afar, and that's not really good doctoring. I will say that there are a lot of similarities between the way Donald Trump acts and the way his father behaved. He patterned himself after his father, and there's been some great reporting about the way in which his father shaped who he is. You know, his father preached that the only way to be good at anything is to basically beat up other people. I don't mean always physically, but to triumph over them, to trounce them. And that has been his business model. And that surely was a thread throughout his governing model. It seems really striking to me that even in an incidents we report on, he's so obsessed with looking like the strongest boy on the playground. You know, he was upset when his health secretary, Alex Azar, alerted him that he had negotiated a deal to buy millions of doses for the United States. Furious, and Azar was flabbergasted. Here, he thought he was presenting a gift on a platter. The reason, Donald Trump said, Boris Johnson will be laughing at me. This is a British company. Why couldn't you have gotten the vaccine from an American company? This will make me a laughing stock. The same with his ability to be drawn to all those authoritarian leaders, Vladimir Putin, Recep Erdogan, the way he wants to have those friendships with him and doesn't want to have them with, you know, the old fashioned traditional diplomats that are our allies.
One questioner wants to know about how you work together. How do you collaborate on a book like this? Do you write individual sections? Do you share sources? You know, here you've done two books, one after the other, and you still get along very well, from all my observation, which is remarkable too. Phil? Yeah.
Andrea, we have a great partnership, and you know, we collaborate in all areas. So we share in some of the reporting, some of the key interviews we did together, including the interview with Trump. Others we did individually in sort of a divide and conquer mentality. And then when it comes to the writing, we're collaborative there as well. So it's not the case that we trade off and, you know, Carol writes the odd chapters and I write the even chapters. We're pretty collaborative and connected throughout the whole process.
Could the attempted and ongoing coup, the attempt to overturn the election, be seen as a dress rehearsal for the real thing to follow later? Carol?
I think that there is a lot of worry, and understandably a lot of worry, that the domestic extremism that Donald Trump energized and tapped into, that came to Washington in part and launched that attack on the Capitol, that group hasn't gone away. In fact, Phil and I talk a lot about how, while we wrote a history book, we view this book as very much current events. Donald Trump is still a powerhouse, and the domestic extremism and anger, even among people that aren't violent, the anger and fear among his supporters isn't going away either. Phil and I had an interview recently on C-SPAN where callers called in and asked us questions. And I was struck by, and Phil was too, about how many people called in to say, you know, this book is made up and you're never going to change our minds about Donald Trump. It's kind of interesting. People have got also, just like Donald Trump, hardened their narrative and are refusing to hear fact. That doesn't bode very well for our future as a nation, our future in working through problems together, and our future that depends on shared facts. So the domestic extremism, I'd have to agree with what former, forgive me, FBI Director Chris Wray said. It's the number one threat in America, and we have to be on guard for it, and we have to figure out what is feeding it in addition to Donald Trump's rhetoric.
And that was never more apparent than yesterday, looking at those videos and hearing that testimony and hearing the through line of racism, white separatism, that was really a large part of that rally. Phil, what were the Trump children, you've talked about Ivanka, but the other children as well, doing regarding the election results? And what about Melania? Do they realize the truth?
You know, it's hard to say to give a perfect answer there, because we did not speak to Donald Trump Jr. or Eric Trump or Tiffany Trump or Barron or Melania Trump for this book. But it seems pretty clear, given the public statements that Eric and Don Jr. have made, both on their social media platforms, but also in interviews and political speeches, that they are in agreement with their father. They are caught up in the big lie. They think the election was stolen and rigged. We have some interesting kind of behind the scenes reporting in the book about election night, where both Don Jr. and Eric Trump are speaking out, as it appears that Biden is starting to win the election and the results are coming in. And Don Jr. Expresses disbelief that Trump can be losing to Biden, and use the F word to say, you know, that effing guy, if I have that quote correct, I hope I do. And then Eric Trump walks through the war room, which is the room set up in the ground floor of the White House with a bunch of computers. And it's where all the campaign staffers had their data terminals, their workstations to be tracking all the precinct data. And he walked through and he said, you know, what the hell's happening? I'm paraphrasing here, but what the hell's happening? How can we be down? We pay you guys to do this, as if it's the worker, it's the campaign staff's fault that the numbers aren't adding up for his father. It was a really strange comment from Eric Trump, but I think it speaks to his entitlement as the son of the president, and the sense, frankly, that most of the people in the family had that Trump was destined to win re-election, and anything short of that was somehow a crime. And you ask also about Melania Trump. She was with Donald Trump on election night. She has been, you know, at his side throughout the evangelizing of this election fraud lie. But interestingly, she did not appear with him the morning of January 6th at the Ellipse at that rally. She apparently was in the White House residence at that time doing a photo shoot of various furniture and decor items that she was doing on behalf of the White House Historical Association for a coffee table book that they're working on publishing. So she had an excuse not to be at that rally, but there's no indication that she has separated from her husband on the matter of the 6th.
Did Carol, did you ask about any of the investigations? The investigations into finance or the inaugural committee or any of that?
We asked about his general like fear or concerns, and he shared that they're just part in his view of the ongoing witch hunt, the ongoing effort to track down and hunt and hurt and damage Donald Trump. But you know, the problem with asking Donald Trump a lot of questions about this is that he doesn't really want to deal in the hard facts. So he doesn't want to talk about a series of tax returns that he and the Trump Organization submitted to the IRS that are super suspicious. You know, having zero income for 7 years in a row, paying your daughter a consulting fee while you're also paying her as an employee. Lots of things like this that were questionable. Didn't really want to talk about those things that are at the heart of the matter that is the most serious for Donald Trump and for the Trump Organization, and that is the investigation in the Southern District of New York.
Phil, could you speak to what you've learned in your reporting about his handling of the pandemic, which dominated so much of the final year of his presidency?
Yeah, so, you know, we learned a lot of new details at different moments in the course of the COVID response, but the connective theme, I think, in everything that we learned about how Trump handled the pandemic is that at every turn, literally every hour of every day as he's making decisions related to COVID, he was prioritizing politics and his reelection campaign. The North Star for Trump was November 3rd, election day. And he would make choices about the pandemic, about what to tell the American people, about, you know, which miracle cures to promote, all based on how does he think, and gaming out in his head, how can he be more popular? How can he look stronger and better to voters come November 3rd? And so that's why, it's the main reason why he downplayed the pandemic early on, because he wanted people to be optimistic about it, and he wanted people to not freak out, and he didn't want the economic, the stock markets to crater, because if the economy turned south, he thought that would doom his reelection chances. And this continued all the way through the pandemic. And he, you know, ended up making a pinata out of Dr. Fauci by the end of the campaign, because he felt threatened by Dr. Fauci. He, according to our reporting, was upset that Fauci was so popular in public opinion surveys, and so would look for opportunities to tear him down, diminish him, belittle him, sow distrust in what Fauci was saying. And you fast forward to today, when, you know, we're on the cusp now of further restrictions with the new Delta variant, in large part because so many Americans, tens of millions of Americans, have refused to take the vaccine. Well, one of the reasons is because they don't trust the vaccine and they don't trust the government scientists. And that's because of what Trump did, the distrust that Trump created among his supporters when he was in office last year.
And that continues in that we've seen Mitch McConnell just taped a video, a public service announcement as a polio survivor about the importance of vaccines and for Kentucky, and that they're putting it up on all these stations in Kentucky, and other people speaking out. Senator John Kennedy in Louisiana, no screaming liberal, telling people to get vaccinated. But the one person who could perhaps influence his followers has not spoken out. It's, you know, pretty remarkable, given what's been happening, Phil.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's remarkable that Trump has not wanted to try to use his bully pulpit, and he still has one, to claim credit for the vaccine and promote the vaccine. I mean, he wants all of us in the media, but also all of us in the American public, to credit him with the speedy arrival of these vaccines. And yet he's not willing to go out there and promote the safety of them and encourage his supporters to take the vaccines. And you'll remember back in December, when public officials started to first get their shots, there was a big press conference, a big to-do, when Vice President Pence and Karen Pence got their shots in the arm. They did it live on television so that everyone around the country could see it was safe and that they were taking their shots. Dr. Fauci did the same thing. Key senators did the same thing. Governors did the same thing. But you did not see Trump taking his shot, and he didn't even let it be known publicly that he had received a vaccine until after he left office. And there are doubters that he actually got the vaccine, because he's never documented it. It's never been shown on camera or any sort of documented proof. We're just supposed to take his word for it.
And as recently as this week, he was putting out a press release speaking about the virtues of hydroxychloroquine.
Exactly.
Carol, there's a detailed question about January 6th, if you could tackle it.
Yes.
As to who gave the order to send in the National Guard? And, you know, was it Acting Secretary of Defense Miller, or did it need authorization from the president? My understanding is it needs authorization from the president for the District of Columbia, because the mayor doesn't have that power, but I think the Pentagon does. And if it needed to be higher than DOD, how could the VP give the order rather than the president? I think if you could sort through that.
Yeah. Happily. So there's a lot of, and has been a lot of confusion about this. In a normal situation, the president has the authority to deploy the DC National Guard, but that authority is almost always delegated to the Army Secretary through the Defense Secretary. In the case of January 6th, however, there was a memo written on January 3rd that basically said that the Defense Secretary, it had to go up to him, not just the Army Secretary, but the Defense Secretary, to authorize the deployment of the DC National Guard. And the reason that this memo was written, according to the reporting that Phil and I did, was because of the anxiety about two things at once. Not wanting to look like military folks were being deployed the way they were on June 1 for that forcible and brutal clearing of Lafayette Square, when Black Lives Matter protesters and George Floyd death protesters had come round the White House that weekend. They didn't want that. And the second thing that was troubling them was this idea of, underneath the radar, the serious adults in the Pentagon were worrying about Trump and his friends trying to get their hands on the guys with the guns. So unfortunately, this was a booby trap on January 6th, because when Chief Sund, the Capitol Police Chief, desperately saw that his troops were outmanned, and I mean the Capitol Police officers, totally outmanned and were getting crushed, when he called for that emergency backup from General Walker, the head of the DC National Guard, General Walker didn't have the authority to send them. And so they had to have an emergency conference call an hour later, more people in danger, more people, police officers having heart attacks, police officers getting bear spray in the face, unclear if they were going to keep being able to breathe. They had an emergency conference call with the Army secretaries, lieutenant generals, two of them, who said, well, it wouldn't be my military advice to give this, to send troops there. And it takes another 2 hours after the defense secretary authorizes it, which he does rather quickly, but it takes another 2 hours for them to arrive at the Capitol. Forgive me, 3 hours. And it's about, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock before they are even on the grounds anywhere useful.
And Phil, was Melania anywhere seen when you were interviewing her? Number of people have asked that. Was she around at the dinner?
No, when we were at Mar-a-Lago, she was not. We didn't see her. We were told that she was there that day, and that she's been spending most of her time there, although, of course, now they're in Bedminster, New Jersey for the summer. But our understanding of Melania's whereabouts at Mar-a-Lago and her routine is that she spends many days, if not most days, at the spa. She has a lot of spa appointments at Mar-a-Lago, and she has dinner with Trump, with her husband, every Friday night on the patio. They have sort of a standing dinner, but it's a performance dinner. So they're at their special table that's roped off with, you know, 100 of their guests all around at the other tables. And that's when they have their romantic husband and wife dinner.
Date night at Mar-a-Lago.
Date night at Mar-a-Lago.
And Phil, maybe each of you can give some thoughts to your choice of the title. It's the second title you've chosen, which is a quote from the former president, but the derivation of I alone can fix it.
I'll just quickly say mine. It's not very long. We chose the president's own words in our first book, Very Stable Genius, the way he described himself. And we chose these, his own words, I alone can fix it, which he said while he was campaigning for office in 2016, because we wanted to stress test his own description of himself to the actual events. In the first case, was he a genius? Was he stable? Most of his aides and close advisors concluded he was not in our book. And I alone can fix it. I think we all know what we found about that, which is that most of his senior and most ardent supporters concluded that he made it worse.
And Phil, have you even thought about another project?
No, there will be no other book. Although if Trump were to run for president again and become president again, we may have to get the band back together in 4 years' time. But I can't even fathom that. And so the answer, Andrea, is no.
Well, such extraordinary work. Great reporting. Beautifully written.
Thank you.
Can't say enough about this book. It's just... and a remarkable collaboration. Kudos to the two of you. You've brought us a great gift. I just recommend people get this and do a deep dive. Even if you're exhausted by the Trump presidency, this is a wonderful, wonderful exposition.
And Andrea, thank you so much for the discussion tonight. You asked really terrific questions, as you have for all 4 years of this Trump presidency, and it's an honor to talk about it with you, and especially in front of a Philly audience, because you're a Philly girl. So thank you.
The honor is all mine. Carol and Phil, congratulations, and our thanks to the Philadelphia Free Library, the wonderful institution that it has been for so many, so many decades. Just have a great read. Have a great night. Thanks,
Andrea.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.